No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Good evening and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about and that affect the lives of all of us. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you. So please join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS Radio and the number 1. You can send us your questions or comments. Tonight, we have a special guest, Stephen Kolb, an organizer, writer, photographer, videographer, and actor from the District of Columbia. He's here to talk about Mayor Muriel Bowser's new plan for D.C. statehood and to tell us why he's decided to video this movement and what he thinks about activism in this new age of technology. So please call in and be part of the discussion. Maria will not be with us tonight, so I'm going to solo. So help me out. I don't want to bore our guest Stephen too much. And call us. Again, the number is 888-627-6008. There's nothing much to report new on the legislative front. In Congress, there are no new co-sponsors of our bill to get statehood in the district, but the House, there's a committee in the House which is attacking budget autonomy in the district. So maybe we can talk about that a little later. But first, let me bring on our guest and welcome Stephen to our show. Stephen has a degree in political science and history from UCLA and a master's degree from USC in public administration and health services administration. He's an activist, an award-winning filmmaker, an organizer, actor. He does it all, and we're happy to have him here with us tonight. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you so very much, Senator. It's great to have an opportunity to share this platform with you.
Well, I, you know,
you're gone. I've lost your voice.
I'm sorry. I'm back.
We're good.
Because of my great technical expertise, I went to move something and I muted and I hit the mute button. So I will try to keep my hands away from the computer as much as possible. But anyway, as I was saying, Stephen has been in the back of the room with his big camera and has seen all this stuff unfolding in our movement. And by stuff, I mean this new initiative to try to get statehood through something that we call the Tennessee Plan. And for our listeners out there, let me just briefly explain. This is the idea for this is that we would make a demand to Congress by putting a referendum on the ballot in November and going up to Congress and informing them that we've met all the qualifications for statehood by approving a new constitution, accepting a Republican form of government, outlining the boundaries of our new state, and demanding statehood. And Stephen's been there while we've unfolded this project. So let's start there, Stephen. What do you think of the idea?
Yeah, I find this whole thing exceedingly exciting. I'm going to give you a little background. My wife and I moved here from Sacramento, California, 8.5 years ago. And I didn't realize that when we took up residence on Capitol Hill, that's the neighborhood we live in, that I'd be giving up my citizenship. And my wife, of course, said, oh, I knew that. It says it on the license plate, taxation without representation. And it didn't resonate with me until I started exploring the subject. And I started making a documentary. Actually, I started attending a lot of events to learn the history of Washington, D.C. as well, old history going back to the 1700s, our middle history through the Civil War and Reconstruction, and then our current history through the Civil Rights Movement and how we got home rule and some of the sacrifices that were made to get that, and then the battles that have raged within Washington, D.C.'s communities of concern about whether representation in Congress would be good, or a vote would be good, or a territorial status would be good, or statehood would be good. And, of course, you, Senator Brown, have made the point that the only thing that really works for us is statehood. But as I've explored this and I've attended events with my video camera wanting to document everything that's been happening, and for me this really started back at the 50th anniversary march on Washington. It was one of the first events that I covered back in 2013. And I saw the energy and I saw the passion surrounding the subject of civil rights. And, of course, this predated the Black Lives Matter movement, as we know it today. But I connected with a part of, D.C.'s history in the flesh that I had not experienced because I hadn't been here that long. And I began to find things that made sense to cover. So every event that I saw, every speech that I saw, every presentation or panel discussion that I saw that might add to my understanding of who I am as a Washingtonian, where I live and what that means, I took my camera and I recorded. And then last summer, I decided to take a cross-country motoring trip to interview people to find out what they knew about Washington and if they knew any more than I did. And so I created a project called Who Cares About D.C. after reading about it. And I interviewed people across country, and a lot of them did not know that we live here. They think of Washington, D.C. as the nation's capital. They see it on a lot of TV shows and movies. They see the Capitol. They see the White House. They see the Washington Monument. They see the Jefferson Memorial in the background. But they don't think about the people who live here. And so that's where I decided I had to do something more about it. And as this New Columbia Statehood Commission initiative kicked off literally 2 weeks ago, at least with a public visibility and citizen participation, I figured the time is right. And I am just absolutely thrilled that Mayor Bowser has pulled together the commission made up of the mayor, Phil Mendelson, the chair of the District of Columbia's City Council, you, Senator Michael Brown, Senator Paul Strauss, and Congressmember Franklin Garcia, who are our elected representatives to serve us. And I think we're on a fast track. It's very exciting. It's trying to, now the challenge is getting citizens in the district to understand what we're doing, to get them excited about it, and then getting people across the country to understand how important this is to our democracy. And that, to me, is still the biggest challenge of all.
Well, I have to agree. I'm sorry, Stephen, didn't mean to cut you off. I have to agree with you 100%. And first, let me just say that I grew up originally in New Jersey, but most of I've been in the Washington area since I was 12 years old, and I grew up right outside of D.C. And then when I became an adult, I moved into the district, and it really didn't hit me either. That as strange as that might sound, because obviously I knew it living in this area for 20 years before I actually moved into the district. But yeah, it really didn't hit me until I was here too, and I had the same feeling that you had. How crazy is this? How absurd? And you know, and of course, how ironic that you should go to things like the 50th anniversary of the Martin Luther King I Had a Dream speech and the March on Washington, and realized that even though things have changed so dramatically around America, across the country in civil rights, things still remain pretty much the same here. And this, what motivates you to do this is also what motivated me to get involved. I read a survey that DC Vote had done. They're a nonprofit group in town that works on this issue. And they found out that 80% of America thought that we had the same rights they did. And why wouldn't you think that? It's kind of counterintuitive to think that the citadel of democracy, the capital of our nation, has very little democracy. And finally, just let me say, before I ask you a question, that we went and testified before the New Hampshire legislature, and there was actually a senator, a state senator from New Hampshire, that said that he served in the military in Washington and that nobody actually lived here. We were all military people and people that worked for the IRS. I mean, we just couldn't believe it. We thought he was trying to make a bad joke somehow, but we never got it. But he really believed. He said all they are is tourists and military people. And we're like, what, are you crazy? We got 675,000 people. So I think what you're doing is amazing. Yeah. And let me ask my first question, which is, why do you think you get this and that other people don't get this? Because, I mean, in your industry, as a filmmaker, as a videographer, because I have always thought it's a fascinating story with fascinating history, and we're the only people in the world that do this. Why do you think more people in your profession haven't been attracted to tell this story? Any ideas?
I can't speak to the profession, but I can speak generally as what I thought of as a citizen. And that is that when I lived in California, all politics was local. Right. And whatever city I lived in, I was raised in Los Angeles, so all politics was local. And I moved to Chico, California, a small college town where I worked for a regional planning agency. All politics was local. And then I moved to Eureka, a small logging town in northwestern California, and all politics was local. I moved to Sacramento, where I worked in state government for almost 25 years, and all politics was statewide. But I never saw beyond Sacramento and the very large, ungovernable state of California, except to think in terms of the federal laws that affected the work that I was doing in consumer protection and regulatory affairs. And I think that's relatively typical of people who live wherever they live and don't think of anything other than the common humdrum daily activities they have to engage in until there's an election, and then they're confronted with things on the ballot that may or may not affect their lives. And life is mean, nasty, short, and brutish. And you have to get beyond that. There's a great story on there's a great TED talk that I heard on the radio today about the life of Abraham Maslow, the psychologist. And he identified various tiers that or levels in your life that will allow you to do things other than just surviving. And it's when you get to a point where you're self-actualizing, you're doing things that are beyond yourself, that you look around and you see, okay, what's wrong here? What can I make better? And one more little piece of this puzzle for me, and I can't compare it to anybody else, and that's I'm Jewish, and I was raised in a family and in a culture in which we are responsible for helping to heal or perfect the world. The term is tikkun olam. And so that's why I've always been involved in reaching out, particularly in the political environment, to see what can I do in some small way to help fix that which is broken, and which is why I've been an anti-war activist, among other things. And I found that creating video messages that tell a story that will hopefully move people has been what I'm about. But why other people don't get it or don't see it, I think, is because each of us lives in our own bubble. You know, you go to work and you come home. And until you're confronted with something that causes you to break out of that bubble, For me, the great changing moment is when I moved from California to Washington, D.C., and all of a sudden I'm now in a very different world with different weather, different culture, different racial and ethnic composition, in a high-density urban setting that I had never lived in before. And it was a wake-up call. And so this whole thing, my whole enterprise, is trying to create a love letter from Washington, D.C. to the rest of the country and the rest of the world to let them know that we are not only the capital of the quote-unquote free world, but we're also an amazing population of people who have fabulous resources and deserve more recognition and respect than we've ever gotten, because people just didn't know that we were anything other than the seat of government and a tourist stop. So that's kind of how I got here.
Well, I've got to say, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Michael. You're good.
I was just going to say that, you know, first of all, I'm a strong believer in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and it's a problem internally for us because many of the people that would be, I think, most helped through representation in both houses of Congress, the poor people of the District of Columbia, of course, have all those other issues to worry about, paying the rent, decent education, you know, and we get tied down by that stuff locally as well as nationally. And so, you know, that's absolutely the truth.
And we struggle with this thing, with these issues. Our population does. Very large number of people who are having a tough time finding affordable housing, and there's a lot of development going on in the district with among developers who are building housing, and we want them to make more of it affordable, so that we have more people who can afford to live where they work, rather than having to move out of the district. But there's the other thing that's really gotten to me is coming to appreciate, not in a positive way, to understand and realize that any member of Congress at any time can do anything they want to keep us from self-actualizing as a local polity, the District of Columbia as a political entity. So when we tried to enact and implement a needle exchange program to inhibit the exchange of needles and HIV transmitted by HIV by IV drug users, some members of Congress said, well, you know, it'll cause people to want to use more drugs, so we think that's a bad thing, so you may not have a needle exchange program, even though we were going to pay for it out of our own budget and implement it locally for our residents. And the net effect is that for the 10 years that we couldn't have a needle exchange program, we had the highest AIDS rate in the country. These are, you know, a death sentence for people because somebody outside the district said, I don't think it's a good idea. So fighting back against these external forces that should not be meddling in the needs of our population, when we can't do anything to them, we cannot unelect them if we don't like what they're doing to them. There is, that having been said, I do have an associate, Justin Robinson, who has created a Not Your District PAC, the Political Action Committee, and he's raising funds to fund people or fund candidates who run against legislators in the Congress who have not been friendly to the district. So Not Your District PAC is a place where if someone wants to contribute, they could, to help fight elected officials who are outside of the district who are, you know, challenging and demeaning us.
Well, I'm familiar with Not Your District PAC, and it's a great idea because that's exactly what we have to do. And as you point out, Stephen, the needle exchange program was a really drastic example of how this affects our everyday life. And you're right. How many people were infected in the 10 years that they wouldn't use our money for needle exchange when it wasn't even our idea, to be honest? It was recommended by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta for us to control are a skyrocketing HIV rate, and it didn't. They didn't let us use our own money until we became the number one city in America with new HIV cases. And even now, there are restrictions on the way we implement the program. So it's just a horrendous consequence. We see the District of Columbia as being the kind of federal testing ground for every silly ass idea that Congress has. You know, if you're a, if you want to court the NRA, if you want to court the NRA, and you come from an area or a state that has very strict gun laws, there's not a whole lot you can, or has very loose gun laws, there's not a lot you can do in your own state. But you can come to Washington, D.C., where we have strict gun laws, and attack them and attack us, and that always makes the NRA happy. Look, we have a caller on line one with a question. Are you there, caller?
Sure. Yes, hello. Yes, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question doesn't pertain exactly to statehood or the needle situation or the new implementation of that program. However, it does pertain to real democracy, and it's about your involvement, Steve. Are you involved with BreakingThroughPower.org that's coming in to Washington, D.C., May 23rd, 24th, 25th, and 26th?
I'm not. Does that have? Is that a sequel to the Democracy Rising movement?
Yes, and Democracy Spring and Democracy. Yes, and Democracy Awakening, too, also. Yes, Ralph Nader is tried to do a promo about it on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. So I'm really hoping that that gets massive coverage, massive. 86 different speakers from all kinds of different programs are going to be there, and it really needs to get out there. Thank you so much.
And what, well, I'm glad what exactly, you I'm sorry, Steve, what exactly is that? Can you explain it to us briefly?
Yes, caller? If you just go to BreakingThroughPower.org, there's a convention that they're coming, and it'll be 4 days with 86 speakers from all kinds of, like Steve said, it's an extension of Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening Group. So it's really critical to get that information, the speakers, and Steve, someone with Steve's activism involved with, you know, live streaming and coverage. We really need help. Thank you.
Well, thanks for calling in, caller.
Thank you very much.
So what do you think of that, Stephen? I mean, we were,
well,
you were,
great. I mean,
you were up there, weren't you, when Democracy Awakening?
I did attend a couple of the events.
Yeah.
Say hi to some friends who were there, because it's very, very, very important to reconnect with them when they do come to town. I mean, part of the beauty of Washington, D.C., is that it's the place where things like this happen. We are not only the petri dish or the staging ground for conservative legislators who want to prove how badass they are to their constituents by doing things to us, but it's also the place that people come to demonstrate, to petition their government, to show that they care, so that the March on Washington, the Martin Luther King Jr. event that happened 53 years ago now, the restaging of that, the Million Man March, and then the restaging of that 20 years later, all of the huge anti-war demonstrations, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations that happened back in the 70s, 60s and 70s, it's a place that people come to participate in demonstrating to the rest of America and to share among themselves that sense of both community and either celebration or outrage at that which that, you know, we don't do Woodstock here, at least not that I know of, but it is a place that people come to show and share. And because of my work schedule, my life schedule, I can't attend these things, and I certainly don't have the resources to record all of them. But I do pick up as much of that as I can, because that, for my purposes, will be part of what's referred to as B-roll, or background footage, to illustrate what makes Washington, D.C. such a significant place and continues to tell our story to the rest of the nation. So, the movements that happen here and that give people cause to come all the way from the left coast, okay, the west coast, and elsewhere, again, to show that they care is exceedingly important. And, of course, getting coverage for it, and that's the hardest part. I started back in 2005 when George W. Bush was elected the second time, and in the face of, and perhaps because corporate media, what we think of as the broadcasters, did absolutely nothing to show what was really going on in our communities. And so I got together with a couple of other activists and creative people, and we created our own weekly two-hour television news magazine that airs, that's actually, it's a webcast just like this, and it's called Media Edge, and the website for that is wethemedia.tv, wethemedia.tv. And so we were out collecting content and shooting and editing and shooting and editing and kind of building a library of material that could be aired on a weekly basis. They're now in 8 different public access channels across the country, and then web streamed and our webcast. And that was kind of how I got started in the digital activism. And it's been a fabulous experience. But, you know, each of us can only go so far. We can only penetrate so deeply before we, you know, you got to come back out of the rabbit hole once in a while to breathe and focus and work on the things that are really, really important. And when I found for myself, and I'm older than I look or act, when I spread myself too thin, I'm no good for any of those projects that I'm working on. But it is exceedingly important that we know what's going on and we do our best to participate and to advocate and to share. And we live in a sharing economy. It's sharing information.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely, Ken, you're absolutely right about us being the center of activism, in the sense that we're kind of a showplace for people to come in and express both their joy and their sadness. I am, as we speak, dusting off my Harley Davidson, because in two weeks, Rolling Thunder will be in town, and I don't know if you filmed them, but this is an extraordinary event. You have to let me digress here for a minute as an old Harley rider, but 500,000 people come to Washington on Harley Davidsons. Well, mostly on Harley Davidsons remember our veterans, and to celebrate America in a lot of ways, and also talk about some of their problems. And it really is an amazing event when you go down there and you see motorcycles as far as you can see.
I live a half a block from the street that most of them come in on, C Street from RFK Stadium. Boy, you can feel it and you can hear it for a very long time as they're streaming down C Street, down towards the National Mall. And it's really quite a beautiful sight. I have a friend who's a lawyer but also a photographer, and whenever Rolling Thunder comes to town, she is not anywhere to be seen in her office. She's out taking photographs of the participants, and she's had some that have sold very well on the stock photography market. It's quite remarkable. For me, Sundays never work out. That's when I have my day job.
Well, I got to tell you, it is an absolutely amazing, amazing event. And you're right. You can hear them. You can feel them. One of the most beautiful moments that I have in the spring is riding down Macomb Street and downshifting on my Harley, which sets off every BMW car alarm on the street. I know it's a terrible thing to do, but it just feels good sometimes. Hey, look, we're going to take a little break and recoup here for a second, and we're going to play, in honor of Stephen's visit, we're going to play a song by the Beatles called Act Naturally. We'll be back in a minute.
Big star. win an Oscar, you can never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star, 'cause I can play the part.
And we're back now, and we're gonna bring Stephen back on. We had a little technical glitch, but he should be back on in a second, and we'll get to talk a little more about his project and what else is going on here in the District of Columbia. It's an exciting time, and we're excited to have Stephen on the show. He's really doing something that I think is very positive for our movement, and we need to get the word out. What we've said many times on the show is that 80% of America doesn't know what's going on. So we're really dependent on people like Stephen to tell our story. Stephen, are you back? Hello, Stephen, are you there? I guess we still don't have him on the line.
Yeah.
So, oh, okay.
Hello.
Stephen, you're back. Thank you. Sorry for the technical problem. Can we talk for a moment? I want you to explain to us, you briefly mentioned We the Media TV. How exactly does that work? And how do people get that? Do they show it in the Washington area? Can I turn on my public TV station and see stuff? Or it's all online?
No. Yeah, DC TV is not one of the subscribing or using outlets for it. But We the Media, the program is called Media Edge. The website is www.wethemedia, as in we the people, wethemedia.tv. And that's where one can find all the programming that they've ever done, all archived. And it shows the date. It shows every program they've got. It gives brief descriptors. Randy Van Dalsen was my co-creator of that program, and then we had a couple of other really good people working with us, Michael Stavros. These are Sacramento people. And they're still there, and they're still producing, and they're still gathering content. They will get the rights to use some material that is in the public domain or in the Creative Commons. But a lot of the stuff that's available was stuff that we created originally. We were the original content creators for a very long time. But then we also discovered, in order to fill 2 hours of content, for 2 hours of programming, we had to go out and find other material. And so there's a lot of stuff that was developed over the years that is now a part of their library of material. But it's well worth exploring. It's some great stuff. And it's not California. It is not necessarily California-centric. It's really the bigger picture. And it was about educating and exciting and informing and motivating an informed electorate, getting people involved. And that's what has animated my work here, is just about getting people engaged. And so since I was sending stuff that I was shooting here back to California for them to incorporate into the programming. And I may still send them more stuff. I've just been so wrapped up in the two documentary films that I'm working on right now, with the third one coming that I may start on when I get these two done. So it's an exciting challenge and exciting opportunity to make the world a better place.
So let me ask you, what's the end game for this film that you're doing on our struggle? I mean, do you plan on putting together a documentary that's full length, half an hour? You know, do you have any sense of that? Or
I really
does,
don't.
As the project unfolds, it kind of dictates what you're going to do?
More so the latter. A good photojournalism, I think, video journalism. I look at this whole exercise as I've got an onion in my hand, and I'm peeling back a layer. And every layer of that onion that I peel back reveals another layer and sometimes tears. But you have to just keep going until you figure out where the story takes you. And clearly there are two ways our story is going to unfold, or three ways. And I don't really want to go into each of those three ways, but I do believe that I'm going to be sticking with this thing until we have resolution of some kind, which is either acceptance or rejection of our petitioning to be a state. But telling that story, becoming the 51st state, is a fascinating process. I'm also shooting for the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., which is part of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And their program coordinator, for whom I'm working for the content that we're creating, is also a member of the bar, the state bar. And when he saw what I was doing, because the Humanities DC content is on the same website, just a different page, as the statehood material that I've been recording, he said that I had a front row seat to the creation of history. So he's very excited about what we're doing and about the fact that I'm documenting it all, because, again, we're at a place we've never been before. And the speed with which this is happening, partly because of technology and partly because of the fierce urgency of now, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, associated with the upcoming November election, the change in Congress and the White House, the role that what we can do to affect, possibly affect the change that we want by having a more favorable Congress and certainly a new president, which isn't to say I wouldn't love to see President Obama have, you know, 8 more years, but that's, Constitution says no. The time has never been better, and that's why pushing so hard so fast is so terribly important. But we need, if you have listeners who don't live in the greater Washington, D.C. area, right, who should be hopefully appreciating what we're talking about and then organizing among themselves, talking with their neighbors and their relatives and their friends and saying, hey, this is going on in Washington, D.C. This is an important movement. We need to let our legislators know how we feel about this. We need our Congress members to know that we think Washington, D.C. really ought to be a state. And while historically we were bound by Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution that created the federal district under exclusive control of Congress, back when the Constitution was written, it also limited votes to white property-owning men. And women couldn't vote. Slavery was in effect, you know, was sanctioned. And we've made a lot of changes to the Constitution. And here's one more change we can make to the Constitution if the will is there to do it. And I'm hoping that we can create that goodwill to say this is important.
Well, that's one of the reasons, Stephen, that what you're doing, I think, is so important. And I've got to tell you, I got to be really honest with you. Your understanding of the issue, it surprises me, given how long you've been involved in this, with how well you really understand this issue. You really do. And I don't know why, for example, we have never been able to quite make other people understand, for example, that they have a front row seat to history here. You know, if we change the way the district is governed, if we become a state, we not only change this for the people that live here now, we change it forever. We've changed history forever. Nobody that's ever become a state has ever left the Union. So once this happens, we're not changing the future for a handful of people, or not a handful, but 675,000 people. We're changing it for millions and millions and millions of countless people to come. And we actually started a website called Teach Democracy in order to get this message out and to say to teachers, look, you can't take your kids across the Pettus Bridge with Dr. King. You can't sit in a lunch counter and teach these lessons to your children the way they were, you know, the way that experiential learning teaches. It's, in my opinion, the best teacher. But you can get involved in the struggle that's going on in the District of Columbia because it's happening now. It will. It's a civil rights struggle, just like all the other civil rights struggle. And you can be part of it, and you can change the world forever. And you're absolutely right. When the country was founded, these people were trying a great experiment with democracy. And the one thing they weren't good about was inclusiveness. No women, no African Americans, no Native Americans, no veterans that were under the age of 21 or people that didn't own property, and no vote for the District of Columbia. All those other groups have been brought in, but D.C. is the last holdout out there. So you're absolutely right about that. Tell us about your other projects.
Well, the other one is the one that really predated or was precedent to the Statehood Project, and that's the documentary film I mentioned earlier called Who Cares About D.C.? It came about partly because I was trying to discover what Washington was and how we got to be the way we are, and I started reading. I picked up every single book that I could find that seemed in the moment to be germane, and one of them was a book by Michael Fauntroy, who's an historian, the nephew of Walter Fauntroy, who was our first elected delegate to first non-voting elected delegate to Congress.
Yes.
A remarkable man in his own right. But Michael wrote two books. One of them is Republicans and the Black Vote. I don't remember the title of the other one. Talk on it. Anyway, so in that book, he wrote about the history of Washington, D.C., and its D.C.'s black population and its connection with Congress. And during the kind of a dark era in our national economy of the Reagan years, when we did go into a recession, there was we also had a mayor whose name is on everybody's lips once in a while, Marion Barry, who did tremendous work for Washington, D.C. in creation of jobs programs, in trying to uplift the family that he had adopted when he moved here from the South as a Southern Christian student nonviolent coordinating committee vote organizer, because that's what he had been doing. He did all of his work down in Mississippi, came to Washington, D.C., and said, we got to do this here in the nation's capital. But he had some dark times, and our economy suffered. And so Washington, D.C. was put under the control of Congress. It always had been, but they stripped away the district government's ability to control its budget. And a budget control board was installed. And I don't remember the full long name of that, but it was described in Fauntroy's book. And the second control board chairwoman or chairperson was a woman named Alice Rivley. And she, as now at the Brookings Institution, she had been chair of the Federal Reserve and the Council of Economic Advisors and a bunch of others, very well-respected person. And one of her reports to Congress was that most Americans, I'm paraphrasing here, most Americans don't care about Washington, D.C., and Congress holds it in contempt. And that got me to thinking, just that term, most Americans don't care about Washington, D.C., a little bit of history. I'm going to jump back to World War II when my mother worked for Eleanor Roosevelt in the old executive office building, what's now called the Eisenhower building. And she wrote letters for Mrs. Roosevelt. People would write letters to the first lady asking her questions or offering suggestions based on her My Day column that was syndicated across the country. And my mother was one of a small team of people who wrote letters in response for Mrs. Roosevelt's signature. And after World War II, my father came back from the Pacific, and my folks moved to the West Coast where I was raised. And my mother always said, until the day she died, the one place she'd rather live than Los Angeles, in a very nice neighborhood, was Washington, D.C., because it was the center of the universe. But she didn't know it in any other way than her affiliation with the administration. She didn't know it as a citizen or a non-citizen, because she was here to work during the war, and that world was pretty well constrained and confined to fighting the war and building a sense of community for America to pull together. I don't know how I got off on this tangent.
Well, you know, let me just...
It's about who cares, So it's Michael, it's about who cares. And so I wanted to ask the question, who does care? And I found a lot of people who do, but don't know why. A lot of other people who do and really know why, and they're terribly engaged, wonderfully engaged. And then there are a lot of people out there who just don't know. And that's, so it's telling our story from the inside out so that people do appreciate what Washington, D.C. is all about. And it's not the I don't think it's going to be the assertive, aggressive message. It's going to be more of a love letter from Washington, from the people of Washington, D.C., to the rest of the nation and the world about what an amazing place this is. And it's not a Chamber of Commerce or a Visitors Bureau piece. It's more about who Washingtonians really are and about why we are so special. That's my hope. But that's just like the Phaser project is an unfolding story with a journalistic approach. So it remains to be seen where it's really going to go.
Well, I've got to tell you, I think that's an important thing that we have to, an important story that we have to tell too. And just let me make a few comments on the things that you said. First of all, I was a political direct mail consultant for 25 years. So your mother had my dream job. I would love to sit in the White House and answer letters to people. But also, I think your comments about Marion Barry illustrate how powerful the media is, because the people that live in the District of Columbia have a much different view, I think, of former Mayor Barry, who we call Mayor for Life, for all the things that he did for poor people in America. That's certainly not his national image, and that's all that's focused on his problems. And that's how most people see him. Those of us who worked with him and knew him knew that he did amazing things to uplift people in Anacostia, which is the poorest part of the city. And that's the thing about Washington, D.C. It's Dickens-esque in the sense that we have the wealthiest people in America and some of the poorest people in America. We have more people with graduate degrees in America. We have more people with graduate degrees in our city than any city in America. But yes, we have high schools where almost 50% of the kids drop out. So there's a real dichotomy here and a real story that needs to be told. And I think it's hard to live in the District of Columbia and not fall in love with the people and the culture and many of the things we have to offer as the nation's capital. And great pride, by the way. People should know that. We all have great pride in this city and being Americans. We know that we've been separated and we don't have the same rights as other Americans, but we're still very proud of the things that we do have. So I think
we choose to live here. Yeah, Michael,
that's right.
I think one of the key points is most people who live in Washington, D.C., a lot came for school and stayed. A lot came for work and stayed. But most of us, I mean, my wife and I immigrated from the West Coast to retire. We came here out of choice because it is the most exciting place in the world. I mean, it's not Paris. It's not the City of Lights. But it is certainly the place that has the most to offer, the most opportunity, the most culture, the architecture is amazing, the old houses. We live in a row house that was built in 1893 for a total cost of $2,000. It cost us a lot more to buy it, eight years ago. But it's a remarkable place.
Well, and as someone that's been born on and raised on the East Coast, we do think of people from California as immigrants when they come to the East Coast, unfortunately. But no, you're right. It's absolutely an amazing place in so many different respects. Can I ask you, what about your work with the Friends Service Committee? And I ask you this because they've always been involved in our struggle, and they're an important part of our coalition. So explain a little bit what you've done with them.
Well, this really was a one-off, with all due respect. When back in 2005. When the American Friends Service Committee, in partnership with Physicians for Social Responsibility and Therapists for Social Responsibility, mounted a project called the BOOTS Project, or the Eyes Wide Open Project. And it was an attempt to give a physical manifestation to the human cost of the war in Iraq. And this is when things were really hot and heavy. And they, the Boots Project started in Chicago, and it toured a number of cities. It landed in Sacramento, and I'm going to blank on this. I think it was about March of 2005. And it was going to be there for 3 days, and I thought, I've got to be a part of this. So I went with my cameras, and I video recorded and photographed a bunch of things that happened during the three-day period that they were there. And my colleague, at my co-producer at Media Edge, said, hey, I need something from what you did. Can you give me an eight-minute piece? And over the next 36 hours, I created an eight-minute piece that showed what I had seen and told a story of the human cost of the war in Iraq. And that little piece garnered me 2 national and 1 regional filmmaking awards. And I was very proud of that. I'm still very proud of it. And I keep thinking, I had 5 hours of video and 200 still picked photos that I had taken during that event. I still have all that footage, and we're still involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the human cost has climbed dramatically since I made that film, and I keep thinking one of these days I'm going to bring it up to date. When I first aired that film, I think it was 1,529 U.S. service members had died, and their deaths were represented by 1,529 pairs of GI boots with the flags for the states represented that those people came from, and the dog tags from that service member. And there were thousands civilian shoes arrayed in a mandala, a maze. And the shoes were infants' booties to old people's shoes in the full age range. And there were thousands of shoes to demonstrate the civilian deaths that were casualties of our war, our misbegotten war in Iraq. And so telling that story in film, in a very brief piece, was what my intention was, and it sure did the trick. So, well, but I've always found the friends to be, and now here we are, their offices of the National Committee for the American Friends Service Committee. American Friends Service is just down the block from where I live, and it's just so amazing to be in the same place where this advocacy is happening.
Well, I commend you for that work, and congratulations on the awards. And that's something which you brought up earlier, that you do see in the District of Columbia. In a couple of weeks, when I go, when I dust off my Harley and hopefully get down to the mall without hurting myself, I will encounter thousands and thousands of veterans who still suffer from a war that ended more than 40 years ago. So we really do have an interesting perspective in the District of Columbia. And you know what, Stephen, we're out of time, but I want to thank you not for only being on our show, but for helping us express that perspective to America. Because I think when America finds out who we are, they will fall in love with us, just like you and your wife have. And I really commend you for the things that you're doing. I think you're an important part of this process. And I hope you'll come back on the show as we proceed, as we progress, and share more with us. Thank you.
Real good. Before you go, let me just give you whocaresaboutdc.com.
Yeah, please give us DC.com. All the websites you've got. Who cares about DC.com?
Who cares about DC.com? And that's where your audience can see what I have done so far, both with the film Who Cares About DC, but the Humanities Program, which is fabulous. It's a great, great educational experience for Washington, D.C., for people who want to know about our history. It's very entertaining. It's very well done. And then also all of the footage that's been shot so far for the statehood movement. And that I will continue to update as more and more things happen, and I have the time to shoot, edit, and post. I look forward. And that's all the raw material. That's the grist for the mill that will turn into the finished documentaries.
Okay, one last time, so you have the last word. What's the website?
WhoCaresAboutDC.com.
Okay, America, go look on Who Cares About...
Explore it.
DC.com, and we'll see you next week. Thank you for being on our show, Stephen.
Thank you, Senator Brown.
Give the people their right to vote.